Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Fluence Forum, presented by AARP of Minnesota, Corn Growers of Minnesota, and by Minnesota's credit unions. Now, here's your host, News Talk 830 WCCO political insider, Blois Olson.
Welcome to the Fluence Forum. I'm Blois Olson. We're starting a series of Fluence Forums focused on Minnesota's most competitive federal races for office. The first one here is Congressional District 1, and the guest is Representative Jim Hagedorn. We're going to have an extended conversation with Representative Hagedorn, and then we're going to have a separate conversation with his challenger, Dan Feehan. Representative Hagedorn, thanks for joining me today.
Great to be with you, Blois.
Obviously, this is a familiar race because you and Mr. Feehan ran against each other 2 years ago. Any big differences that you've seen in this race or amongst what voters have on their minds right now?
So in 18, we beat Feehan by a close margin, but we overperformed. I was one of only two Republicans in the whole country to take back a Democrat seat. Pete Stauber in northern Minnesota was the other. This time, of course, President Trump is on top of the ticket. He carried this district handily in 16. He's very popular down here in southern Minnesota. And together, we've been doing good things out in Washington, making sure we secure our borders, have a strong defense, keep the economy rolling with free market principles. We're rebuilding that very strongly coming out of coronavirus, and protect our basic constitutional rights, you know, life, guns, and God, basically, is the way we look at it on that standpoint. So I think, it's the same race in the sense that Feehan's not really running on any issues. He doesn't get out much to the voters. They've got a lot of money from around the country pouring in for him, but I travel the district, stay connected with folks, and I think we've done good things for the people of southern Minnesota these 2 years.
You know, one of the issues in southern Minnesota is I've traveled and talked to specifically farmers, you know, and you've talked about this. You talked about it in 18. You've obviously had to deal with it as a member of Congress. There's some strong frustrations with the Trump administration and agriculture, especially corn and beans related to trade and renewable fuels. I know you recently had Ag Secretary Perdue in the district. Can you talk about any influence or thoughts you've given to the Trump administration on these issues?
So on the ethanol program, I've worked with Democrats and Republicans alike. Could be people like Colin Peterson, Cindy Axne of Iowa, it didn't matter, to make sure that the EPA implements the ethanol and biodiesel program, the renewable fuel standard, the way Congress intended. We've made some gains on that. The EPA is no longer doing the small refinery waivers. The president came out and said 15 billion gallons of ethanol and 2.4 billion gallons of biodiesel will be blended. The secretary, Mr. Perdue, reiterated that at our event in Albert Lea. And things are moving in the right direction there. We just need to get the economy back open and get some demand for gasoline and driving so we can sell those products. But, you know, as far as trade's concerned, look, I championed the USMCA and expanded better trade deals every day that I was in office. I know that we overproduce in agriculture, and we need to have markets across the world. And we're finally seeing that come to a head and in a good way. Just this past month, the largest orders for soybean and corn to China were executed. Commodity prices have been ticking back up. Hog exports and hog futures are ticking back up, and we've got an incredible bumper crop. So if you get around the district as I do, you'll find that farmers are optimistic again. Farmers are actually looking forward to the future. And some of these things that needed to be worked out on trade and everything else have been taken care of for the most part, and we're moving the right direction.
Obviously, farmers were hit, hog producers you talked about, by COVID-19. The meatpacking plants, other places. Any new ideas on how to make sure that they can recover faster?
So I introduced a couple of bills myself to help our hog farmers, especially livestock producers, were really hit hard when the restaurants closed, and then we had packing plant disruptions, as you said. And so they either had to euthanize animals because we had excess supply, couldn't get them through the packing plants, didn't even use the meat for the food supply, and or they had to sell into depressed markets. So my bills would help mitigate those losses. But we've done some things in coronavirus relief packages early on, the CARES Act. And then the Commodity Credit Corporation was utilized by the Department of Agriculture. I talked with Secretary Perdue about that again yesterday, a couple of times to help our farmers. But we need another relief package, especially for livestock, biofuels, and others. And I hope we'll get that after the election. We should have had it already, but frankly, Speaker Pelosi's kind of been dragging her feet on that. The whole goal is to get our farmers from one side of the coronavirus to the other, our independent operators. We don't want them to go out of business. When they do, it puts enormous pressure on our small communities and hurts the food supply chain. So I've been working very hard on the Agriculture Committee on those issues. And I think, I really appreciate the support of the Farm Bureau, the corn growers, the soybean growers, and the pork producers who support our campaign.
Now, as we pivot, the other big issue in southern Minnesota, obviously with the Mayo Clinic, is healthcare. Can you talk about where you stand on healthcare and maybe how it differs from your opponent?
So during this term in Congress, I've had a new experience to understand the value of world-class medical care as we have in southern Minnesota, whether it's at the Mayo Clinic or our fine rural hospitals. Just 45 days into the job, I was diagnosed with stage 4 kidney cancer. It was a complete surprise. I had no symptoms. And luckily, I started treatment at Mayo Clinic shortly after that. And since then, the treatments have gone fantastic. The immunotherapy treatments, I haven't missed a day in Congress, haven't missed a vote due to illness. I'm very grateful. I always say the healing hands of God and the healing hands of Mayo Clinic are bringing me through. But we need that experience for everybody across the district, no matter what their ailment. We want timely, quality medical care. And so I also went to bat for our rural hospitals to make sure that they didn't go broke during coronavirus when elective surgeries were shut down. And we were able to work with 35 Republicans and Democrats to make sure HHS sent out a proportionate amount of funding. So I've been looking out for it. Look, what the Democrats have in store, if they get elected, whether it's Biden, Harris, Dan Fian, Pelosi, it doesn't matter, is they're moving towards more government and more government insurance reimbursement versus private insurance reimbursement, and that's going to put half of our rural hospitals out of work. They'll make them go broke, according to the studies, and it'll certainly undermine the model of medicine that we have in Rochester with the Mayo Clinic. And if you want to know what things are going to be like if things go south a little bit there with the Mayo model, they had to furlough 25,000 people during coronavirus. It devastated the businesses and the community, and if we have anything like that moving forward, it'll destroy the economy in and around Rochester. And I'll never support that stuff. And instead, what we need is competition across state lines, association plans that would make sense, let people shop for their insurance, drive down costs. You know, these Obamacare insurance rates are outrageous. Price transparency. You should know what it costs to go to the doctor and get a procedure before you get there so you could shop around, save money. And then finally, high-risk pools for people with pre-existing conditions, much the way we had here in Minnesota before Obamacare. And that way, everybody gets timely, quality medical care. But considering 5% of the patients consume 50% of the medical care money, I'm one of them with my cancer treatments, we don't want everybody around those patients to have to pay higher premiums. So high-risk pools would take care of people and make sure other people didn't have to pay exorbitant costs.
One of the big issues in the presidential race is the Affordable Care Act. You referenced it in your answer. Why isn't there a more specific Republican alternative to the Affordable Care Act after all these years?
Well, because we don't want a top-down government approach. I mean, what we've said is, you know, if you have the federal government setting all the rules and deciding what's going to happen down to the hospital or the doctor-patient level, it's going to be a mess, and it has. Obamacare, remember, the people that put that together, they promised you get to keep your doctor, keep your plan, and save $2,500 a year. That was the promise. A lot of people didn't get to keep their doctor. A lot of people had their insurance plans canceled or couldn't afford them anymore. And everybody would probably be ecstatic if they only had to pay $2,500 more a year rather than even save some money. So the same people that offered that up now want some form of socialized medicine, public option, Medicare for all, single payer, whatever. And that's gonna make things worse. What Republicans have said in the absence of Obamacare is, We just need concepts that work across the country. Like I said, if you have nationwide competition where associations can get together and offer insurance plans across state lines, there's going to be massive competition. You're going to be able to let people go out and purchase what they need and move along, and it's going to be cheaper. If you have price transparency, so you know what it costs to go in to get your MRI before you get there, you can shop around. And if you have out-of-pocket costs, you're going to save money. That's only common sense. On prescription drugs, same thing. I said one price, one pill. The president signed that as an executive order. Now the people around the world and foreign countries are going to pay more for their prescription drugs. Americans will pay far less. Those concepts make sense. And then lastly, high-risk pools. We want everybody to get timely, quality medical care, have the advanced treatments to live the longest, best lives possible. That's we can have that in America, but not everybody around them has to pay for it. Have the insurance companies, have the state and federal government put into a pool. So when a patient like myself or anybody else that has very expensive medical needs meets a threshold, then the pool pays it. Still get the same care, but the pool pays it, not all the premium holders around that person. And those types of things make sense. They work. And we have seen the price of insurance come down a little bit since we got rid of the mandate under Obamacare. But you need to scrap that federal system and go to things that allow individuals, doctors, and others to make their own decisions.
As you talked about Mayo and the impact on COVID, just generally in the economy, you talked about, you know, there needs to be another COVID relief package. You point to Speaker Pelosi as, quote, dragging her feet. What else can you do to try to encourage more bipartisanship on the next COVID relief package?
Well, what we've done in the House as Republicans is try to work with our colleagues in the Senate to get a package that'll make sense. I in particular have been working with Senate colleagues on agriculture provisions to make sure that we take care of our livestock producers and others. And as a conference, we've wanted to make sure that there's more paycheck protection money. $138 billion is sitting out there unused. That should be going to small businesses that are still struggling. We also need to ensure that businesses and banks can just pay off under $125,000, those loans, so they don't have to go through a bunch of paperwork. We should have liability reform in there so businesses and schools that open up aren't sued frivolously, and they can have confidence that they can do their jobs and not have to spend a whole bunch of money on lawsuits. And then on the unemployment issue, I mean, look, we can't have a situation where people make more on unemployment than they do working full-time jobs. That certainly isn't fair to the people who are out there working full-time jobs. And remember, tens of millions of people have been working throughout this entire coronavirus situation across our country. But we want to make sure folks get back to work, that there's some incentive to get back to work. There's a lot of demand out there. A lot of businesses that are dying for folks to come back to work, and we shouldn't cut that short.
You bring up the Senate. Democrats point to Mitch McConnell. Republicans point to Nancy Pelosi. You worked in Washington. Now you've represented Minnesota and Washington. How polarized is Washington, and what is the difference between what people see in the headlines and the TV ads versus maybe how things actually get done?
Well, from my perspective in the House, Speaker Pelosi has brought up a number of key bills that instead of, you know, trying to do it bipartisan in the House, she puts in poison pills that she knows the Republicans won't support. It goes all the way back to the border, for that matter, when she wanted to have a resolution to say that the border wasn't a crisis, as the president said, and then all of a sudden there's division. But transportation bill, she brings up a transportation bill with $1 trillion of Green New Deal provision she knows the House Republicans will never support, the Senate won't vote for, and the president won't sign. And yet that's her bill. So you're just wasting time and doing messaging things. Prescription drugs. There were three bills that came out of Energy and Commerce that had almost uniform Republican and Democrat support to have generic prescription drug reform that would have made more competition, driven down costs for the American people. I would have voted for it. Almost every Republican would have voted for it. But on the way to the floor, she put in some Obamacare provisions to bail out Obamacare, and she knows the Republicans won't support that. So honestly, I don't think the Speaker wants the President to be able to look at the American people and say, I promised you this, and we delivered. I think that's kind of where we are, unfortunately. And until that changes, you're not going to get the Senate to vote for it, and the president isn't going to sign it. I don't know what she's up to except trying to message and say, look at those terrible Republicans voted against our bills.
Two of your colleagues from the Minnesota delegation, Dean Phillips and Pete Stauber, have joined the Problem Solvers Caucus. They've had some success in bringing Speaker Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, Democrats, Republicans together with some compromise plans. Why didn't you join that caucus?
I don't believe in those types of caucuses, honestly. We're just out doing our work. And I think, frankly, if Dean Phillips wanted to bring small businesses some help, the better way to do it would have been to sign the discharge petition to bring up our paycheck protection bill to the floor. And that would have been a much more effective way than to say I'm part of a caucus and we're going to put pressure on the speaker. The only people that can put pressure on the speaker are the Democrats. Now, Republicans have no authority to do anything with the speaker because she has the vote, she has the power. It's the Democrats. And if they want to go, you know, push the speaker to bring up good bills, that's great. And I'll commend Dean Phillips or any Democrat for doing that. But otherwise, that's where we are.
You know, one of the issues that has emerged this summer is criminal justice reform. Your district mm-hmm. is much more diverse now than it was 5-10 years ago. How do you feel about the way in which people of color are treated in your communities by police and any change that you see needed on either a federal level or a local level?
I don't appreciate the way the Democrat Party and the rioters in the streets, not the protesters, but the rioters in the streets have taken situations here and there that they think weren't right. Now, none of us believe Mr. Floyd should have been treated that way. But in other cases where there's some question marks, and then they use it as an excuse to go out and tear down cities, burn down cities, things like that, try to defund the police. You know, our law enforcement officers do heroic work day in and day out. And I have a lot of admiration and respect for them. And they protect and serve our communities, and they are the difference between chaos and an orderly society. We have to stand up for law and order, and I do. I'm very much appreciative of the Minnesota Fraternal Order of Police for endorsing my campaign, along with the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. And I think the reason they support me is because I've supported them. Do we want a society in which we have equality, where we have people that are treated fairly? Of course. And the incidents with police are few and far between. When they happen, people should be prosecuted. People should be brought to justice. But to say that we should be defunding police and undermining police and not respecting them and going out and rioting and that stuff, that's unacceptable. We haven't seen the rioting in the streets, of course, in southern Minnesota, and I hope we never do. But it started in Kenosha, Wisconsin one day, and I suppose it could happen anywhere. I hope it never happens here. But what we are seeing is the fallout where the morale of police is low, people are retiring early, and it's very difficult to fill police officer positions with qualified candidates. Because the Democrat Party, for whatever reason, and these extremist organizations that they support and vice versa, are out there demeaning, defaming, defunding, going against the police. And one quick thing, Speaker Pelosi brought up a bill on police that was outrageous. It would have taken away their qualified immunity. My opponent, Fian, supported that. I voted against it because we can't have police subject to frivolous lawsuits, forcing police to go get their own insurance. A lot of police would quit on the spot if that happened. And that's just another example of how the Democrats and my opponent don't support the police, and I do.
You know, there's been a few stories in the last few months from your congressional office to maybe a campaign office issue. The most recent one is about your campaign office that you've had for a long time. It showed up in Politico just right before we recorded this. What do you have to say about that story and your campaign office?
That story is completely false. They're claiming that I've been receiving rent-free office space in the old Brett's building in Mankato since 2013. We do have what's called Suite 007, but that's a post office box. It's not physical space. The reporter was told that. The reporter wrote the story anyway. He's a Democrat operative. Politico should have known better than to even publish that thing. But we have not had that office space since 2013. It's nothing but a post office box. Suite 007 is a post office box. And so the only time we ever had any space in that building was from March of 2018 through the election. And we paid $100, which was on our FEC report, for unfinished basement space that we used mostly to store signs. It's a completely made up story. And this reporter, Neuhauser, whatever his name, has done it to us many times. And of course, other people in the press are just happy to continue that along. And I'll say that I'll address that stuff in my office that happened. I mean, we sent out mailers to the district. All that was fine. All of it was in, within budget. The Democrats signed off on all that. So that's been a little bit misreported. But when I found out that my chief of staff had hired his brother to do the work, which actually technically is not against House rules, but when I found out about it, I took corrective action. I canceled the contracts, made personnel changes. I reported it to the House, and I did an investigation, or an internal review, so we could give the House every bit of information possible. I acted completely honorably as soon as I found out about it. Certainly, it's my responsibility because it's my office, even though people did things that I didn't approve of. But we've gotten to the bottom of it, and I've done the honorable thing. Conversely, though, my opponent has some issues, and I brought this up in a KEYC debate. Dan Feehan has been given hundreds of thousands of dollars by Democrat front groups to run for Congress. And if he didn't do the work, which he's never been able to show anybody that he did any work, that's an illegal camp. Those are illegal campaign contributions in excess of Federal Election Commission limits. Those are felonies. Now, we brought this out, and Dan said he didn't know anything about it, never had accepted the money. And he said that he was just an unemployed guy who was being supported by his wife. It turns out his wife's been getting money from the same types of groups. I don't know. Hopefully she's doing the work. But I know in Dan's case, he hasn't been able to prove that. I'm a little disappointed that some of the news outlets haven't wanted to ask Dan these questions about, well, what did you do to earn hundreds of thousands of dollars in a short period of time? I'm sure the people in southern Minnesota would want the same opportunity. Everybody would like to have some sort of no-show job. But in this case, when you're running for Congress, it's a felony, and he has some explaining to do.
We're going to ask Mr. Feehan about that when we interview him, and that'll be right after this interview with Jim Hagedorn. Jim, as we wrap up here, what is it that you want voters to know to send you to a second term?
Well, first, I mean, we looked out for the interests of the district, whether it was our farmers, small businesses, medical care providers. Those are the big major economic and interests of the district. So we paid attention to that. We helped deliver the money to fund Highway 14, the completion from Nicollet to New Ulm. And also I stood up and defended law enforcement, our police. And so I think I've done what the people were looking to do. Been a conservative, supported a strong defense, supported an economy with free market capitalism, and then, of course, our basic constitutional rights. But the country's future is on the line. I mean, the Democrats offer a country with radical socialism, which is not going to even be something we recognize moving forward. And I think what the president and I and others are trying to fight for is the country envisioned by the founding fathers that has been the envy of the world for over 240 years. So I humbly ask for the vote of the folks. I let them know that I'm going to keep fighting cancer. I'll keep fighting for southern Minnesota, and together we'll all keep fighting for America.
Thanks, Congressman. We'll talk soon.
And when the Fluence Forum returns, Blois will be joined by Democratic challenger Dan Feehan.
Fluence Forum, presented by AARP of Minnesota, Corn Growers of Minnesota, and by Minnesota's credit unions. Now here's your host, News Talk 830 WCCO political insider, Blois Olson.
Welcome back to News Talk 830 WCCO. This is the latest Fluence Forum, where we're talking to candidates for federal office. And today we're focused on the first congressional district race. You just heard from Representative Jim Hagedorn. Joining me now is challenger Dan Feehan. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Boy, thanks so much for having us. Honored to be here.
No problem. Hey, Dan, you ran again. You're running again this time after narrowly losing in 2018. What's different in 2020 versus 2018?
You know, I think you have to start with the very plain, clear idea that 2020 is different. We are living in a very challenging time, and it's a time that is calling for leadership and calling for service to one's country. You know, growing up in southern Minnesota, you served your neighbor. You don't have to agree with your neighbor, but you take care of each other. And that's the value I've tried to live my life with. Joined the Army after 9/11, serving two combat tours in Iraq, coming back home, becoming a middle school teacher, serving in the Pentagon on behalf of millions of service members, making policy for them. The through line of all of it is that people had to come first. People must come first. And I look around at 2020 and I see people coming last. We have a representative in Jim Hagedorn that has put corporate special interests first, voting against prescription drug reform, being a part of a lawsuit to take away protections for pre-existing conditions in the Affordable Care Act, and whose own personal corruption. I've lost track of how many scandals his office has been a part of with taxpayer money, but one of which nearly $500,000 of taxpayer money is unaccounted for. People need to come first, and the consequences have been enormous that I've seen here in southern Minnesota. And so, you know, when I was in the Army, there was a real simple leadership motto: when in charge, be in charge. And I think what's most different about 2020 is what you're fighting for. First and foremost, ending this pandemic with a national strategy to test, to trace, to provide PPE, making affordable healthcare and affordable prescription drugs, while also making sure to fight for and protect our rural hospitals and clinics. And really, to take away the influence of corporate money on our politics. And you can really only do that if you're an independent voice. The thing I'd say is, you know, the oath a member of Congress takes is to the Constitution. It's not to a political leader. It's not to a party leader. It's to the Constitution. And I know that because it's the same oath I took as an Army officer. And I think our strategy is focused on making sure people know that there's an independent voice who knows how to lead, who's ready to fight for them. And we are making sure every person in southern Minnesota knows that, whether you're in a city, in a rural community, or somewhere in between, you're going to hear from us and know that someone's going to fight for you regardless of whether you vote for them.
Dan, that makes sense that that's your pitch to defeat an incumbent. You know, a couple things. One is your campaign did decline a debate on WCCO. You've had trouble getting the debate scheduled last week with Representative Hagedorn. If you have such a compelling case, why haven't you accepted more debates?
Well, we pretty straightforwardly came to negotiated terms with Congressman Hagedorn on what debates we would be doing and where. And with it, you know, very, very directly, we had an opportunity last week in Rochester that I was very much excited for. But unfortunately, Congressman Hagedorn was directly exposed to COVID, making an in-person debate unsafe, frankly, per state and federal guidelines. We offered to do a virtual debate instead, and he rejected that as an opportunity, which is unfortunate. There are still opportunities for voters to hear from the both of us, and I'm looking forward to those opportunities as much as I've had the opportunities already behind us, which we've seen a very clear contrast of what type of leadership and representation you can expect for southern Minnesota.
You talk about COVID-19 and a national strategy. There's been very different experiences throughout even the first district with COVID-19, from Rochester to Worthington, all over the district. Can you talk about how a national strategy would fit the first district so that there would be either flexibility or no flexibility for schools, for workers, for businesses?
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm someone who spent a lot of time in national security overseas and working in the Pentagon. I was part of the original fight to prevent the Ebola virus from coming to the United States. A national strategy means that you are directing resources, adequate resources, to where they need to be, because there is no single state that can provide adequate resources for themselves. And frankly, as long as there is one state not doing as well as the others, we are going to continue to have problems. What a national strategy looks like is still as relevant today as it was back in March. Just talking with the Mayo Clinic and virology experts there, they still need resources when it comes to testing. Every part that comes with a test has a logistics component to it that, again, the federal government can bring incredible resources to bear. And when it comes to things like you mentioned schools, I have a first grader and fifth grader right now. They're in-person school here in Mankato Public Schools, and they're wearing masks, spread out, socially distant. But the reality still here right now is that, you know, that school has no ability for a rapid test today. And meanwhile, we're watching professional athletes who have instant access to tests. It's that kind of inequity that makes it incredibly hard for a school to stay open and to do so in a way that's delivering equal education to every student. It's just not happening right now. Schools are opening and closing all around southern Minnesota, And the inequity of this virus is playing itself out in full. It plays itself out when people aren't able to access their doctor in terms of broadband internet, and the ability for virtual healthcare, or the frankly, your ability to still get a test. I know of people who still wait multiple days to get the results of a test. Again, that's a federal issue where they can provide adequate resources so that testing comes back instantly. So you know where the disease is, you know how to contain it with tracing, and then PPE is there to make sure everyone who needs it has it. There are still hospitals and clinics who are reusing PPE, even now, almost 9 months into the pandemic. That national role is going to be critical because we can shape what the world looks like, what our country looks like, months down the road if we acted today. But still, because of the failure of this administration and a member of Congress like Jim Hagedorn, who instead of advocating for these things, who has actively espoused conspiracy beliefs around COVID-19 and spread disinformation, which does no service to Southern Minnesotans who desperately need this pandemic to end.
Southern Minnesota is a very diverse district. You brought up the Mayo Clinic. What's your view on healthcare, the Affordable Care Act may be in jeopardy, or people within the Democratic Party may push for a more nationalized plan? What's your solution on healthcare, considering the Mayo Clinic and access in your district?
Absolutely. Healthcare is a function of having to move forwards. We have a very contrasted vision of healthcare, of moving backwards, that my opponent presents. He presents it because he's part of the lawsuit to take away, to make the ACA unconstitutional, and with it, protections for pre-existing conditions. No one I know wants to move backwards. But moving forward is not accepting a status quo. The status quo right now, let me just sharing with a story of a family. It's not a story, it's their lives. Family who has a 12-year-old with a pre-existing condition, severe physical disability. You know, they have struggled to have affordable health care from the moment their child was born, and they had $1 million bill waiting for them after they got home from the NICU. But in the pandemic, it's even gotten great, even challenged more greatly, because they required 7 days a week in-home care in their house. And about 2 months ago, they had a healthcare worker come to their house, like happens every day, except that healthcare worker came to their house while they were sick. That healthcare worker then left, tested positive for COVID-19. And boys, as a parent, this last 8 months has been incredibly stressful, worrying about your ability to keep your kids safe. And they had to quarantine upstairs and downstairs, waiting for the days to tick by. And thankfully, COVID didn't pass on to that family. But for that healthcare worker, they asked them, they were upset. You know, why? You were sick. You knew the rules. Why'd you come to work? And their answer, I always come to work when I'm sick. In other words, it wasn't a choice. They had to come to work. They couldn't miss a day of work. So when I talk about moving forward in healthcare, it consists of having more options. And that's the idea of a public option to be able to buy into, or lowering the age of Medicare to 55, for example. So a 55-year-old has a more affordable option that's out there. It's making what's available more comprehensive as well. And with it, the underinsured or uninsured in Southern Minnesota have a chance to seek preventative care in a way that they simply choose not to because of cost right now. And that's where it helps our hospitals and clinics here, especially our rural ones. They need more business. They need to see more patients. And if patients are more insured, then they have a chance to actually seek that care. But the degree that matters only matters as much as the reimbursement rates that come with it. So whether for Medicaid or Medicare, I'm going to advocate very hard to raise reimbursement rates, because that's also part of the hospital's bottom line, too, to stay open and functioning. And lastly, two more points on that. You know, the internet has presented itself, broadband internet throughout the state of Minnesota and this country. We've seen the inequity in communities. We've also seen the limitations of something like virtual healthcare. And so when you talk about access, if you can access a doctor from home, it's all the better, because you don't have to travel the distance to get there. But if a lack of internet is in the way, well, that has to be part of healthcare reform too. And lastly, prescription drug costs. You know, talking to families across the district, they have seen noticeably prescription drug costs go up during the pandemic, and a pharmaceutical industry that's making billions off of our health at the same time. I'm going to fight for simple things that should be happening already, like allowing Medicare to negotiate directly with drug companies, allowing generics to compete on the open market in a far fairer fashion, and closing the loophole on Medicare Part D as well. All of these things have to happen. And the bigger, broader vision is moving forward on healthcare. so that there are no more underinsured or uninsured in southern Minnesota, and that everyone can seek preventative care, which benefits all of our rural hospitals and clinics that need more people to use them in the first place.
What about the idea, though, that the Mayo Clinic has its kind of model, and other healthcare institutions in your district have their model? How do you make sure those can piece, you know, can coexist both competitively and provide access?
I think that comes down to how you're going to represent. I view partnerships as the way forward for everything. And so I have spoken with the Mayo Clinic already to begin what I hope to be a very productive partnership, because they have to be an active participant in the conversation around healthcare reform, not just because of the outsized influence they have around the world, frankly, but because they have an incredible amount of expertise that has to get brought into the conversation too. And so that partnership I've established with them is one that I will absolutely be turning to make sure and understand how any changes that have already taken place in the last 8 months, but future further changes, that they're a part of that conversation, fully invested in that conversation. Because if they're not, we all stand to lose out as a byproduct of that. That's the type of representation you can expect with me, partnerships in every way, shape, or form.
One other major industry in southern Minnesota is agriculture. They've had also various challenges with COVID-19, but they've also had challenges over the last few years. What would you bring to agriculture policy that maybe Jim Hagedorn or President Trump haven't brought?
So I think, for a farmer looking out right now, we're thankfully great weather, last little stretch here, and what looks to be a stronger yield in certain parts that I've talked to across southern Minnesota, but still low prices. You know, this has been now the third harvest in the middle of a trade war in which our farmers have taken the brunt of the entirety of what is ultimately a failure. We have gotten nowhere of the whole reasons we got into a trade war all alone in the first place. And I think that matters, because I don't know how much longer we can ask our farmers who open these markets over generations to stand idly by and take the brunt of this. You know, I think there is two things that stand very clearly between my opponent and I. One, a willingness to stand up to your own party. In the case of this, where I have not seen Congressman Hagedorn stand up to this administration on agriculture in any way, shape, or form, including on waivers for oil refineries when it comes to our ethanol here in southern Minnesota as well. And that has an impact here. Someone's got to be fighting for our region. Agriculture is regional, and no one is fighting for our region right now. And secondly, it's that corporate influence. You know, Congressman Hagedorn takes money from oil companies, and then as a result, doesn't fight nearly as hard as he needs to when he sees ethanol plants closing here in southern Minnesota, and our corn producers having far fewer places to sell their crop as well. I think those are big differences between us. I am someone who's committed to being a part of the agriculture committee. Colin Peterson is committed to putting me on that committee. And to have someone who's actually going to stand up for the region, because I have enough context to understand that under Democratic and Republican presidents, farmers have been hurting now since maybe 2012 at this point. They need someone who's actually going to fight for them, help to open new markets, help to get new trade agreements around the world so that we can reach those with our crops, with our produce, with our livestock here. And that has to be from a place where you are independent-minded, willing to argue against your party, like I did just a couple weeks ago when my own party tried to leave farmers out of an aid package in the current budget. But you also have to not be under the influence of corporate special interests that go against our farmers. And I am both of those things, independent in every sense.
Dan, you continue to bring up Representative Hagedorn, his contributions from PACs. He's made an allegation, it's been reported on widely, that there are Democratic aligned nonprofits that have paid you and for your services or on contract. What have you been paid for by those nonprofits, and can you explain that to voters?
Yeah, absolutely. I am proud of the work I've done to help provide for a family with three children, an incredible partner and spouse, Amy, as well as the work there, which includes national security work, writing on the consequences of nearly two decades of war, including helping both veterans and teachers find new ways to serve, helping to design curriculum for them along the way. And what has been very clear is that multiple independent news sources have gone through this with a fine-tooth comb and seen that the allegations, slanderous allegations that Congressman Hagedorn has put out there have been debunked, and that there is nothing to them. And I think it's important to call out why he would be doing something like this. As I've mentioned, he has numerous scandals going on in his own office that are leading to him being in a very desperate, desperate place that he will try to throw anything at the wall to stick. But the reality of his ethics in office has led to nearly $500,000 of our taxpayer dollars being unaccounted for. And the difference of reporting around this, you should appreciate as well, multiple independent news organizations have called out that what has happened with his office, with our taxpayer dollars, is fraudulent or even illegal at best. And that's something that I want to keep talking about, because it's so telling about him. At a time of crisis, he has chosen to enrich himself and his friends instead of fighting for Southern Minnesota.
One of the big topics that people talk to me about is polarization. You've been pretty harsh on Representative Hagedorn. How do people kind of get through that to not think this is just you being a Democrat polarizing people against a Republican?
So I am harsh to call out the influence of corporate special interest on our politics, because it's Republicans and Democrats. And I think it gets in the way of true progress on issues that matter most to people, like healthcare, like the cost of prescription drugs. And I'm able to advocate that because I'm willing to call out both Democrats and Republicans who are under that same influence, and one just happens to be an opponent. But it goes further than that. You know, I think it's important to call out that being a member of Congress is public service. It's public service to your representatives. That's who you're beholden to, whether or not they vote for you. And I think that the strongest difference between my opponent and I is that I don't see you as red or blue. I see you as a hardworking Southern Minnesotan who's trying to provide for yourself, for your family. And there are so many things getting in the way of that, including dysfunction in Washington. That is a part of the polarization that is much bigger than Jim Hagedorn alone. And what I would say to that is that my entire life has been dealing in tough situations with groups of people that didn't necessarily see eye to eye. Now, I was a 23-year-old platoon leader with a group of soldiers, more diverse than this country itself, plenty of disagreements, but we found roadside bombs together. We were able to come together. We were able to take care of each other with a group of middle school students that definitely didn't see eye to eye with each other, but we all learned together. I'm willing and able to understand that compromise is necessary to get things done, and that you have to humanize each other to get things done too. Again, I don't see you as red or blue, because I think that is a narrow viewpoint that too many on the far extremes of both parties have adopted here in 2020. I am someone who believes that leadership means you are accounted for no matter what. Something has to get done. And so if your celebration is to be arguing with the other side, I think you're in the wrong, because that's not viewing the job as public service. And I think that's the biggest difference between my opponent and I.
As we wrap up here, two Minnesota members of the Congress, Pete Stauber and Dean Phillips, joined the Problem Solvers Caucus. What kind of work will you do if you're elected to not be partisan?
That's certainly one avenue I've looked at myself, having talked to Representative Phillips in particular about that idea. More broadly, I think what's really important to notice over the last two cycles is that public service backgrounded candidates are getting elected, both Democrats and Republicans. And there's a commonality there. It doesn't necessarily mean military experience. It means you've been in a place where there was no alternative other than getting something done. And I think we are now reaching the point that there's the potential for a cultural shift. And so I look to align myself with people with that similar idea and background of I've been in a tough place where something needed to get done. I'm going to look beyond the idea of party and know that the oath I take is to the Constitution and to the people I'm there to serve in the first place. That's the approach I'm going to take. I'm also going to take the approach of fully arguing that there is no monopoly on good ideas in one political party. There is no monopoly on bad ideas in a political party. And importantly, another reason I'm running for Congress is that it has to become a co-equal branch of government again. Over Democratic and Republican administrations, we have ceded power to the executive branch, and that has taken disastrous consequences in many different forms, including in foreign policy as well. I am there to be a check and balance on whoever the president is. And that's what I think Southern Minnesotans should expect from their representative as well.
Our guest has been Dan Feehan. He's challenging Representative Jim Hagedorn in the 1st Congressional District. We had planned to have a debate, but due to COVID-19 concerns and an inability of the candidates to agree, we weren't able to do that. So we brought their views to you on this Fluence Forum. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Blois Olson for News Talk 830 WCCO.
The preceding program is paid for by AARP of Minnesota, Corn Growers of Minnesota, and by Minnesota's credit unions. News Talk 830 WCCO, KMNB HD2, Minneapolis, St. Paul.